The post-war contract stressed the serendipitous nature of research. I would argue serendipity is not a strategy.
From the University of Ottawa's Institute for Science, Society, and Policy, this is Disruption Discovered, a show about the forces that are reshaping the 21st century and the people who spend their days thinking about them. Welcome. I'm Brendan Frank. Since World War II, the basic arrangement between science and society has been this. The scientific community receives public funding and maintains a high degree of autonomy. In exchange, the public receives considerable but unpredictable benefits. But this arrangement is under strain. Science is needed now more than ever to help address the disruptive challenges we've discussed on this show. But our approach to science, how it's funded, how it's produced, how it's put to use, must evolve to remain relevant in a post-truth context. So what exactly is necessary to reinvigorate the social contract between the public and the scientific community? Here to discuss is Jeff Kinder. Dr. Kinder is the Executive Director of Science and Innovation at the Institute on Governance, a nonprofit that promotes principles, standards, and practices which underlie good governance in the public sphere, and a senior fellow here at the Institute for Science, Society, and Policy. Welcome.
Thank you, Brendan.
So why does society need a contract with science and the scientific community?
In Canada and throughout the industrialized world, we have largely tied our future to advancements in science and technology to support economic innovation, our health, to protect the environment, national security, etc. And as a result, we spend a lot of public funds, about $12 billion annually at the federal government level, to support science and technology. And I would say for both of these reasons, it makes sense to have a social contract or a basic compact, a basic agreement that guides the relationship between science and society.
But this agreement is largely unspoken.
That's right. It's an implicit contract.
So what is the history of this social contract? When did it first emerge and what was the need based on?
Yeah, the current social contract emerged largely in the wake of the Second World War. Because prior to the war, there really had been very little funding from the public sphere to scientific research. But as part of the war effort, the scientific community was mobilized in order to achieve victory. And science produced many, many contributions, including radar, the proximity fuse, and of course, the atomic bomb. And then the question became, how do we maintain this tight relationship between government and science to support peacetime goals after the war? So in the U.S., President Roosevelt at the time asked his science advisor, Dr. Vannevar Bush, to develop some advice around this question. And Bush's landmark report, The Science, The Endless Frontier, became the blueprint for post-war science. Its basic tenets were promulgated by the OECD and were largely influential around the world, including in Canada.
So the influence of that report has lasted throughout the decades, but something has changed. What's different now? What's driving the need to renegotiate this social contract?
Right. Well, as influential as it was, it obviously was a reflection of its times, and times have changed over the last 75 years. So there are perhaps a few examples I could point to illustrate how our thinking has evolved since World War II. So first, even the very notion that there's a contract suggests that there are two parties, separate parties, so science on the one side and society on the other. But unfortunately, this suggests that science is apart from society and not within society. A second example would be that the social contract really only suggests that there are benefits that flow from science. And yet we know, of course, that new science and technology can often raise challenges as well. The post-war contract really had little guidance to provide in terms of the ills that might flow from scientific research. A third area would be this issue of autonomy, which was central to Dr. Bush's argument. In fact, he famously wrote that, quote, scientific progress results from the free play of free intellects working on subjects of their own choice in the manner dictated by their curiosity for exploration of the unknown. Now, we know that the scientific community resists anything that smacks of planning and the bureaucratic control of research. And consequently, the post-war contract privileged bottom-up basic research conducted at universities where scientists enjoy academic freedom. But it raises questions of how we should pursue more mandate-driven research to address public purposes, for example, the type of directed research pursued in government labs. A fourth area would be that Bush argued for what has come to be known as the linear model of research and innovation, which is a really simplistic view of how innovation works. And we've learned a lot since those days about the innovation process. Finally, I would point to the post-war contract, very much privileged natural and medical sciences and engineering, with little regard to the social sciences and humanities. It really had nothing to say about interdisciplinary science and the interdisciplinary approaches that we need today.
Okay. Would you mind talking a little bit more about the linear model that is now viewed as outdated? What has changed specifically?
Absolutely. So the linear model very much suggested that by putting resources into basic research, the kind of fundamental research done at universities, that that would create new knowledge that could be picked up by others who would then do more applied research in response to a particular problem, and that would ultimately lead to new technologies and new innovations that would get introduced into the market. And it's not necessarily wrong. That is one way that innovation happens. The challenge, of course, is that as we've studied innovation, we realize that there are a lot of other avenues and pathways to innovation, a lot of different types of innovation. Today we talk about things like social innovation or policy innovation, and these follow a very different model than the linear model proposed by Dr. Bush.
So trust is fundamental to the social contract, but trust in Canadian institutions worldwide, actually, is in decline. This year's results from the Edelman Trust Barometer, which came out in February, suggest that 65% of Canadians don't think that the government understands emerging technologies enough to regulate them effectively. 62% of Canadians think the pace of technological change is too fast. And 45% of Canadians worry about their jobs and losing them to automation. And perhaps most concerningly, 48% of Canadians don't believe that scientists behave as ethically as they should. So how do we reconcile that? How do you renegotiate a contract when segments of society don't trust that we're capable of managing new scientific findings, or that the application of these findings, for instance, with automation, mm-hmm. isn't necessarily in their interest?
Absolutely. And immediately following World War II, of course, the scientific community was viewed with a bit of awe by the public, given the high degree of success that they had contributed to the war effort. So they enjoyed a high degree of prestige. But as you say today, the indicators are much different. At that time, the government was willing to accept the science community's argument that only science can judge science, and that, frankly, the public should trust the scientific community to select research priorities that are in the public interest. The contract also asserted that the scientific community must be allowed to police itself, and any ethical breaches were basically treated as housekeeping issues and should be handled through the scientific community's internal mechanisms. So we saw occasional calls over the last 75 years for more public accountability, but often that would lead to criticisms that the public was anti-intellectual, or that there were too many bureaucratic strings attached to research funding. Fast forward to today, and again, according to surveys, in particular, according to a 3M survey, 58% of the public view scientists as elitist. There is less trust in government, as you noted, and less deference to expert authority. Recent media reports of scientific misconduct that we've seen in recent weeks suggest that internal self-policing mechanisms may not be enough to ensure scientific integrity. So while the scientific community continues to argue for autonomy, the public is seeking greater accountability, especially given the large expenditures that we have for public research. And in such an environment, I would argue it's not persuasive to say that all we need to do is raise the scientific literacy of the public, and then they'll be more supportive of science. We just need to look at, say, climate change deniers or anti-vaxxers. You know, they're not going to be more convinced simply with more evidence from experts. And so scientists need to listen to the public's voices. We need to more systematically consider who will be impacted by advancements in science and innovation. And we need to aim for a greater compatibility between scientific advancements and the public's capacity to absorb them for society's benefit.
And what about innovations that there is limited control over? Like the toothpaste cannot be put back in the tube. I'm thinking, for instance, about social media and the spread of disinformation, right? They're publicly traded companies, but their software and algorithms are proprietary, and there's no real way to reverse how these innovations are being used or abused.
It's a good point, and I certainly don't have all the answers. But I think what we're trying to think about in this initiative around a new social contract is, can we bring the public in at an earlier stage of the innovation process to actually have their input on whether these are the innovations that they're looking for? And then hopefully that will help steer us towards a greater compatibility between these new innovations and what we're looking for.
So I was hoping you could talk a bit more about that. Scientists have a role to play, but non-scientists and the public writ large, where do they fit in? I assume that reversing the decline in social trust is not a problem that scientists will be able to handle themselves.
No, absolutely not. In fact, we need to open up the scientific process to better engage non-scientists. For example, if you look back at the post-war contract, its view of the research process had little or no input imagined by non-scientists. Basically, there was no role for the non-scientist in the process. And yet today, we see that the government is pushing open science, for example, and that's very important. But even here in open science, what we typically see is a push for greater openness for the products or the outputs of science. For example, we want open access to scientific publications and scientific data. I think we need to go farther. And for example, we need to open up the conduct of research. We can start doing this through approaches like citizen science and inclusive innovation. Of course, science requires highly technical knowledge and technical training, highly specialized knowledge, so there are limits to what we can do here. For example, we wouldn't expect citizen scientists to develop the coronavirus vaccine, and we wouldn't want amateurs running the research reactor at Chalk River, but we can engage scientists and citizens in better discussions about the scientific process, about research questions we want to pursue, about the costs associated with research, as well as the benefits that may flow from science.
There's never going to be a headline that says social contract between science and society renewed. So how do we know when we're successful? What does success actually look like? Or is it just a question of seeing the social trust metrics reverse in terms of their trends? Or are there broader measures of success that we can look to?
Yeah, you're no doubt right that we shouldn't expect a victory celebration anytime soon. But I do think beyond just reversing those indicators, as you mentioned, I think there are sort of five elements to success that we might look for. So first of all, a sense of mission. The post-war contract stressed the serendipitous nature of research. I would argue serendipity is not a strategy. We need to better link the research that we support with public purposes and grand challenges. And here, perhaps the UN Sustainable Development Goals would be helpful. But I also want to emphasize that in stressing the need for a mission orientation, this is not an argument for applied research over fundamental research. I think that's a false dichotomy that serves no one well. I think a mission orientation allows for both types of research and may help justify the public expense and rebuild public trust. So a second area would be expanding equity, diversity, and inclusion. The post-war contract was clearly dominated by white men and a narrow definition of science. So can we expand the participation of historically underrepresented groups and be more inclusive of the social sciences and humanities, of interdisciplinary research, and other ways of knowing? Third, public engagement and inclusive innovation. Can we open up the processes of research and innovation to the public, as we spoke of earlier? Can we reframe our concepts of excellence to include perspectives on social acceptability, social utility and need, etc.? If we look at peer review and project selection, for example, they're generally conducted behind closed doors, making decision-making very opaque. I would argue the public needs a seat at the table, not just because of the billions of taxpayer dollars that are at stake, but because it can make for better research outcomes. Fourth, broadening the skill sets. Everything I've listed in the first three points will require different skill sets. So can we imagine incentive systems, including promotion and tenure processes, that reward mentoring, community engagement, science communications, knowledge mobilization, policy relevance? And finally, connecting globally. The post-war contract was couched very much in terms of national systems advancing domestic interests. Yet we know that the biggest challenges facing Canadians today are the same ones faced by all of us around the world. So a new contract would better support today's challenges and opportunities, which are increasingly global and require international collaborative approaches.
In terms of creating different incentive structures within university, rewarding different types of activities, how do you create an incentive for a university to reframe its incentive structures.
I think the federal government, through the research councils and the power of the purse, can help shape the incentive systems that we use at universities. Obviously, scientists will follow where the money is, and to a large extent, the government can influence the promotion and tenure guidelines that are used at universities. They won't be able to dictate these. Obviously, this will be a collective effort. But as an ecosystem, there seems to be growing recognition that we need to modify our incentive systems to encourage this type of public engagement. These are just some of the possible elements of a new contract. The post-war contract has served us well for 75 years. I would argue that it's now time to look ahead to the next 75 years.
Which would take us to 2100 almost.
Almost, yeah. So it'll be a blueprint for the 21st century, if you will.
And as far as further reading and recommendations, are there any books on the social contract, or do you have any resources for people who might want to learn more, or ways they can get involved in this initiative?
Well, I would say stay tuned. We're just beginning to explore these issues at the Institute on Governance and here at the ISSP. Definitely there are some resources that we can point you to, but if you're interested in getting involved, please contact me.
All right, we'll put the contact information in the credits. Dr. Jeff Kinder, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brendan.
The social contract between science and society that followed World War II has produced an amazing array of benefits in medicine, telecommunications, energy, and beyond. A new social contract must be broader, focusing not just on the next scientific discovery, but the unintended consequences of scientific discoveries, past, present, and future. A more mission-oriented, inclusive, publicly engaging, and globally focused social contract can help accomplish this. It can also help to rebuild trust between citizens and scientists and ensure that new discoveries allow us to navigate the challenges of the 21st century without leaving anybody behind. Disruption Discovered is produced by Alicia Aziz, Eric Cinnamon, Raphael Desordi, and myself, Brendan Frank. Our composer is Jackson Palmer. Special thanks to Jeff Kinder and the Institute on Governance, and to Jonathan Deegan and the University of Ottawa Library. For more information on the Institute on Governance, you can visit their website at iog.ca. For more information on the Institute for Science, Society, and Policy, issp.uottawa.ca. Thanks for listening.